Welcome to Real Clear Radio Hour, brought to you by the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'm your host, Bill Frezza. This week, we delve into two forces that inexorably change the face of America: immigrants who come here and the next generation that rises to take our place. In the second half of our show, pollster Emily Eakins will give us a rundown on views held by millennials as revealed in a recent Reason Foundation poll. Up first is Penn State professor and founding director of the Center for Global Business Studies, Faraboz Gadar, whose new book, Becoming American: Why Immigration is Good for Our Nation's Future, looks at the myths and facts behind this complex and controversial subject. Faraboz, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here, Bill.
In your book, Becoming American, on the very first page, you make the bold statement that our nation's prosperity is built on the renegade, risk-taking, entrepreneurial concoction of truly American innovation and invention. How do you tie that to immigration?
Well, if you look at the number of Fortune 500 companies that were started by immigrants, that's 42%.
42% of today's Fortune 500 companies
were started by immigrants.
That's an astounding number.
It is. It is. It is unbelievable. And you know, the percentage of newer ones are actually even higher. You know, if you look at the very successful new ones, the Googles, the eBays, all of these guys are started by immigrants. 10 million jobs are created by these companies, and $4.5 trillion of our annual revenue is from these companies.
Well, I just look across our venture portfolio, and without immigrants, our companies would collapse.
Yeah, that's very true.
So those are some of the good statistics, and I hope you share a little bit more. But what about the bad statistics? Aren't there claims made about high crime that immigrants are involved in?
Now, that's the interesting thing. Of all the elements that we studied, and we looked at some myths that we said people think about immigrants, and it's really actually not correct. The statistic that is most accurate is the irreverse correlation between immigration and crime.
They tend to stay out of trouble more.
Because they're afraid. The reality is, if you're an immigrant, you don't want to get stopped by the cop. You're going to get into trouble. So you basically are straight and narrow. You know, it's a percentage of the white population is significantly lower compared to the African American population. It's lower. If you compare it by region, any state that has a higher percentage of immigrants, the crime rate is lower. And any city or county that has a higher percentage of immigrants, the crime rate is actually lower, which is a very interesting thing, because when you talk to people, they immediately say, oh, there's immigrants, this must be, you know, a more dangerous area.
Well, how do these myths get started?
You got me. I mean, I guess the news media covers it. I mean, the incarceration rate of U.S.-born is 3.5%. That's four times the rate of the foreign-born, which is 0.86%.
Wow. What are some other myths in that category that you bring out in your book?
Well, the thing that is really amazing is that when you talk to, our fellow Americans, they all say we're a nation of immigrants. And that's true. We have a lot of immigrants. We have more immigrants now than we had 100 years ago. But if immigrant is defined as a person who lives here, who's American, but is not born here, the percentage is only 13%. And that is in line with France and Germany, which would not consider themselves a nation of immigrants. And it's roughly half the percentage of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
Canada is one of the success stories in immigration, isn't it, in terms of
that's
the kind
right.
of people
Canada
they attract?
Canada is 24%. We're 13, Canada is 24%. In fact, the interesting thing is that I was interviewing some folks in Silicon Valley, and I came out of the Apple area, and I was coming down the highway, and these huge bulletin boards that they have, it says, if you're having trouble with your visa, consider coming to Canada, and paid for by the Canadian Immigration Authority. And I showed that to one of the Canadian councils here in Washington.
Oh,
I said, what is this? He started laughing. He said, yes, that's what we're doing. And when I was at Microsoft, I said, you're having trouble getting H-1B visas. These are the visas that are given to, you know, highly qualified people that corporations want. And we allocate around 85,000 per year in two or three categories, but the demand by the private sector is close to a million.
Wow. Isn't the argument that these H-1B visa recipients are taking jobs from Americans?
Well, that's the interesting thing. The H-1B visa, if you look at our immigration policy, who comes here, it's really bimodal. It's at the low end, mm-hmm. where the guys who take care of your lawn,
right,
and paint your house,
lettuce,
et cetera,
and putting up drywall.
Exactly. And then at the high end, which basically does your robotics and does your biotechnology, mm-hmm. does your software development. And the unemployment rate in that category is so low that people are dying to find people like that. So no, we are not taking jobs away. In fact, companies are panting to get that kind of capability. And in fact, when they don't get it, the companies go and set up operations overseas.
Isn't that exactly what Microsoft did, setting up in Vancouver?
Exactly. I mean, if you look at one of their buildings in Vancouver, it says where all the brilliant people live, or something like that at the top of it. And that's where anybody who can't get H-1B visa in the U.S., they get them and place them in Canada. Well, I mean, each one of those people, you know, have a purchasing capability, have expenditures, have other people that have to support them. So by them not being here, you actually are losing jobs.
I think it's tough for people to make an argument that at the top of the barbell, jobs are being stolen because those folks create so many more than they fill. But what about the bottom of the barbell? What about the lettuce pickers and the gardeners and the drywall construction people? Aren't immigrants taking jobs from them?
Well, if you look at it, it falls into two or three categories. They're seasonal categories, mm-hmm. you know, picking fruit, which is what your example is. Mm-hmm. And we have special immigration policies where people are allowed to come here, pick the fruit, and then at the end of the fruit season, go back.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to work relatively well. But then the guys who come and take care of your garden and paint your house, etc., really, the immigrants that come to fill that hole don't take away jobs from Americans, because just basically the Americans that are born here often don't want that job. And it's easy to say that, but in fact, at the price, at the treatment, that they don't want it. And in fact, if you look at the long term, that is going to be a problem in the U.S. because up to now, immigrants at that end of the spectrum have come primarily from Mexico and Central mm-hmm. America, mm-hmm. primarily Mexico. And the difficulty is that immigration from Mexico has actually gone down. In fact, illegal immigrants from that region peaked in 2007, 2008, have been going down.
Well, it follows the economy. I mean, if the economic demand is not there.
Our economy is lower, and B, Mexican economy is growing. But if you look at the long term, looking at the success that the Mexican economy is having, we're going to find out that flow is going to dry out, and we won't have the people that we want.
Given that the highly educated, you know, degreed PhD folks are not unionized, and generally the lettuce pickers and gardeners are not unionized, why are unions so adamant against immigration?
Well, because the perception is, if you look at it, if one person loses his job and he's a union member and he starts complaining a lot, nobody says, yes, you lost your job, but the fact that these other 10 people are there have created another 15 jobs where some other union members have been hired. It's difficult to quantify the second portion of it and sell it, because if you got a job because, you know, the person who founded the company was an immigrant, you don't go around tooting your horn and saying, you know, gee, I got a job because of the immigrant. But if you lose your job because an immigrant takes the job away from you, then you're quite more vocal about it. So it's a matter of really who gets the horn and yells loudest.
Isn't that how most of our policy works
country? That's exactly right. But it's unfortunately, this is such an important element of our economy that I don't think we should let that happen. And if you look at, for example, the industries that we were successful over the years, they really were tied to what I call clusters of economic development. Mm-hmm. So in the 50s, we had a cluster of automobile development around Detroit. Eisenhower put the roads together, and next thing you know, we've got a major industry. Mm-hmm. Go 20 years later, we've got a economic development in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. that's our IT capability. Well, look at it in the future. So what clusters would we need to have? We would need to have a biotechnology
right.
cluster.
Healthcare for sure.
Nanotechnology clusters, healthcare clusters, and robotics clusters. Well, all of these require skills that we need to a large extent, develop internally in the U.S., but also there's experts from all over the world right. who have to come here. And if we don't do that, we will lose that cluster capability. I mean, it was disappointing to go to China and find out this huge biotechnology mm-hmm. cluster being developed. It should be in Boston. I mean, Boston has got one, but not in the scale and scope that the Chinese are putting together. And we need to get these people to come in here. So that's why I'm so worried that, you know, this rhetoric.
We're cutting off our nose to spite our face.
Exactly.
So Faribault, and I have to confess, I have a hard time calling you Faribault because I knew you as Bob. full disclosure, we are both members of the same MIT fraternity, although you graduated before I got there. How come the name Bob didn't stay with you? That's certainly how I remember you.
Well, it's interesting. When I joined Chi Phi, they didn't have a Bob in the fraternity. And of course, every fraternity has to have a Bob. And nobody could say Faribault, but there was a B in the middle of it. So I said, well, you're Bob. So I said, okay, I'm Bob.
And
that's really the nature of immigrants. Basically, you know, they assimilate and get so I became Bob. So for all my fraternity brothers, I am Bob. And then my professional writing, of course, is Faribault Godard, but that's so complicated my kids can't even mention
right.
it. So everybody refers to me as FG. So I'm FG, I'm Farry, I'm Faribault, I'm Bob, depending on who calls.
And it all works. You know, I can't tell you how many relatives I have who claim their names were changed on the way through Ellis Island because they were basically unpronounceable to the bureaucrats who checked them in.
I mean, we're now a lot more sympathetic to that, and the names stay, but many of these names, we don't even have that letter
the
of
sounds.
The alphabet.
Yeah. Which raises the issue of assimilation. You know, I was raised in the melting pot generation. My grandparents were immigrants. They spoke foreign language, Italian and Greek at home. My parents learned English in kindergarten. They spoke without an accent, and they became Americans. In fact, your book is called Becoming American. Is that changing? Are immigrants assimilating at a slower rate than they used to? Are they learning English at a slower rate? And is their culture more resistant to change?
We looked at that in great detail. It is difficult to sort of get accurate statistics, but we looked at level of English spoken first generation, second generation, third generation. And in fact, how quickly you learn English is actually slightly faster now than it was at the turn
really?
Of the century and before. Yep. So the first generation gets 93% English proficiency, the second generation 96. That's substantially higher than the Italian population in the beginning of the last century, a lot faster than the German population that came in. In fact, one of the quotes is, Ben Franklin talking about all these Germans who are coming here and ruining our culture and not learning English, etc.
I guess some of the complaints never change.
That's true. So yeah, the assimilation is actually slightly faster if you measure it in terms of how quickly you learn English. Of course, there are still, you know, these clusters of communities that get
Chinatown
together.
Chinatown, and yeah, sure.
Chinatown, Koreatown, etc. But even those have gradually sort of dissipated.
And what do the intermarriage statistics look like?
We don't have accurate intermarriage statistics. But generally, the statistics that we have is that if you intermarry, you become American much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at that, and that's not in the book, but it's a measure of SAT statistics. Okay? Now, this is really fascinating. First generation comes here and they're doing okay, but they haven't taken the SATs. Their children have a higher SAT score than the average American.
Sure. They're more education focused, more driven.
More education focused. They whip them into shape. They don't dare say anything, et cetera. The generation afterwards, the SAT score slips. And by the third generation, they're straight American SAT average scores.
So
they may be brilliant Vietnamese or Chinese or Korean, but by the time they're three generations here, they're completely American.
It's reduction to the mean.
That's right. Exactly. So that's another interesting statistic that we found.
So Faribault, we're seeing a lot of troubles in the Middle East today. And as I recall, that's exactly what brought your family here back in the 70s.
That's right. Actually, brought them in the 50s and then in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
My parents immigrated here to Michigan in the 50s during the first revolution in Iran. And then when the monarchy came back in, they all decided to go back to Iran. And then when the revolution came in 79...
With the Ayatollah.
Dad has retired and I came back to the States. And that's really a nature of a group of immigration also. You have political instability and you leave. But it's not just political instability. It's also lack of opportunity. If you look at particularly in the Middle East, the number of kids that a woman has, and varies from country to country, anywhere from 2 in Turkey to 8 in Yemen. When you have that many kids, as they grow up, you need to find them jobs. You have to need them, you know, housing, spouses, this, that. And the economy can't really cope with that kind of youth bulge. So what happens is when people are educated or have the capability of leaving, they leave.
You get a diaspora.
Exactly. I mean, another interesting statistic that's not in the book, but it's pretty obvious. There's more Egyptian doctors in the U.S. than in Egypt. And in fact, the multiple, I think, is like 1.4 or 1.5. And you would look the same thing for engineers. I mean, if you get a brilliant engineer from Sharif University in Iran, even within this environment where they're so difficult for Iranians to immigrate to the U.S., they tend to get to come here because the companies really want them, their expertise. It's a fantastic technical school. They come here. And of course, then on the other extreme, you got not immigrants, but you got refugees. And when situations like this arise, you got refugees. I mean, if you look at the number
fleeing
of refugees, basically it was Vietnam and Burma, and now it became Afghanistan and Iraq. So we, in addition to the brain drain, you also have the refugees.
So we seem to be going through another bout of nativist hysteria. There's been a lot in the news about the illegal alien children that are piling up at the borders. That seems to be waning as 5 more crises hog space in the newspaper. But one thing is clear is that Congress seems to be gridlocked. There doesn't seem to be a lot of change in immigration policy. When we look to the north and we see how Canada has done it, what can we learn?
Well, if you look at what Canada has done, and let's look at the H-1B, the highly educated one first. Okay. In that category, we have H-1B visas. You have to apply for it. The application process is quite difficult, so companies one by one can't do it. So you get these headhunting companies that basically hire the people, get the allocation within the first 2-3 weeks of the year. Then the rest of the year, you have to wait, and you don't have any allocation. Then the headhunter places you in different places, and eventually, hopefully, the immigrant stays. In Canada, what they do is they have a list of all the potential immigrants, and the companies basically go and look at them and say, okay, I want number, you know, 4250. And
it's like a dating service.
It's like a dating service, and you pick them and say, I want this guy, I want that lady, I want this person, et cetera. And they come to the beginning of the line, and then they basically go and join the company. So the companies select what they want from a pool of immigrants that they basically identify. And they're not restricted to 10% of what the companies want. They're much more lenient and much more. We need something like that. We need something where our companies can basically scan the world, identify the people they want, and scan the database of immigrants that are waiting to come here and request some kind of high priority for them.
So this is basically a what would be good for America policy. Let's get the good ones.
I think so. Now, whether we can get it through, whether they're, I would think that corporations are strongly supportive of that. I know Zuckerberg is, I know Microsoft would be, Apple is. So, especially in the West Coast, a lot of these companies would be supportive of that. I think in the Boston area, a lot of companies would be supportive of that. These are things that are really not going to replace American jobs. These guys are, if they could find people that could do those tasks, they would certainly hire them as a, you know, just like that.
So in theory, it should be non-controversial.
It should be non-controversial. The question is that immigration is never subcategorized. You sort of bundle it into a whole slew of things. Another category of immigration is people who want to come and invest here. There is a special category of that. If you invest, I don't know, $1 million, $2 million.
Come write a check.
And hire, and hire a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. So not just the money. The money has got to come. It's got to set up a business, and you're going to have to hire people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, then you go to the beginning of the line. The Canada also has a very effective one of that.
So we could act as a big sponge for capital and the kind of people who are good at accumulating it and allocating it.
And allocating it, exactly. So it's not just accumulating it. They got to come here and invest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another category. Right now, our immigration policy is heavily towards family.
And is that for historical reasons?
And that's historical reasons. So if you get married, your wife immediately can become American. Then all of a sudden, her parents can come here. Her kids from the first marriage can come here, this, that, and other. And that's a very nice humanitarian gesture. But from an economic policy point of view, you really should revisit that. Who exactly is family? How easily should they be allowed to come in? And what criteria is there? At the other extreme, the percentage of the population that's illegal immigrant is really dropping, and it's dropping relatively rapidly. And furthermore, as the economy picks up, the issue sort of goes away.
People are less concerned
more
about
it. Exactly. It becomes more of an issue. We have a recession. Recession hit. Immigration is a big deal. Now, as the economy starts picking up over the next 2-3 years, that will also disappear.
People might be a little less hysterical about it.
Exactly. And as manufacturing moves back to the U.S., that will also reduce some of the impact. The issue, however, is this refugee system. And we can manage refugees from Afghanistan and, you know, Vietnam and Burma and Iraq. Very difficult to manage refugees that are 5, 6, 7 years old coming from Honduras. And that's the problem at the border. Mm-hmm. These are truly refugees. Our hearts go for them.
But now what?
But now what?
Yeah.
And this really is not an immigration issue. It's a refugee issue. It's how many refugees do we want? What kind of refugees do we want? And if we don't want them, what are we going to do about it?
How can they be placed?
And exactly. So that is the tricky part of it. And that's the one, of course, is always in the newspapers. And you see the poor kid there.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, you know, but, you know, he really should be with his mother, or she's got lice, or he's been misused,
right,
or this and that. I mean, that's a sad component of humanity, but it's
really
a refugee.
Of the big issue.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Faribault, as we look forward, what do you think are some of the key issues we should address?
Well, Bill, I'm in the business school, so I look at it more from an economic point of view, from a business point of view.
Mm.
If the U.S. is going to be the major industrial power that we want it to remain, we need to make sure we develop the clusters that are necessary. Biotech, nanotech, robotics, IT, et cetera. We need these people. We need to attract them. We need to bring them in. Another component is all our foreign students that come here get their PhDs. They used to love to stay here. Now they're leaving. One of my top students from China didn't want to stay here. She went and worked for Goldman Sachs in Hong Kong. Another one of my top students was working for Honeywell, but he wanted to go back to Bangalore and work. That's fine, but if we're educating these guys and they come here and we educate them, why are we sending them away? Why not try to keep them here? And the one that comes to my mind is when I was on the plane in Ohio, there was a PhD candidate studying hydraulic fracking for oil and gas industry, and he couldn't get a visa to come here, despite Ohio and Pennsylvania, et cetera. He ended up going to Australia. I think that's a shame.
And we lose on that one.
I think that's a shame. We really need to do
it. So you're basically recommending that we develop an immigration policy based on our national self-interest. What a concept.
Exactly.
Faribault, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was a pleasure being there.
That was Professor Faribault Goddard from Penn State, author of Becoming American, here on Real Clear Radio Hour, brought to you by the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'm your host, Bill Frezza. Ahead, pollster Emily Eakins will tell us why she considers millennials to be the politically unclaimed generation. Stay tuned.